This episode of Life Zero is proudly sponsored by local restaurant Perea at 795 Valencia. In 1989, I was making a living basically hacking or programming satellite chips, and people would pay $200 or $300 for a pre-programmed satellite chip so that they could get, you know, all the satellite channels.
Are we talking about television?
Yeah, satellite television.
Got it. Those big dome things.
Yeah, the big satellite dishes that people used to have out in their yards. Yeah.
So these were sort of gray market alterations to off-the-shelf hardware stuff?
Yeah.
They'd buy it from their provider. And
well, yeah, it was like a little EEPROM, and you could pull it out, and they basically essentially baked into the software that they loaded onto the EEPROM what channels you had available. When they would come out and install, you know, quote, all the new channels, mm-hmm. they would literally just replace the EEPROM.
Right.
It was kind of funny. And then they got smart and figured out a way to hook it up to the phone line so that the phone line could automatically update the EEPROM, but that wasn't until probably 90 or so, 91. Mm-hmm. So from 88 until about 90, I had a pretty brisk side business while I was trying to make my way through school selling EEPROMs. Anyway, I met this guy named Mike Jackson, not Michael Jackson, Mike Jackson. Mike Jackson is the largest, he basically owns a company called Roy Sales, he and his brother. Roy is his brother. And they own a company that is the largest distributor of, at the time, Spanish cassette tapes and now Spanish DVDs, like the largest distributor. Like if you go to Kmart or Walmart, I guess now, and you look in the Spanish cassette tape section, you know, pick out 10 Spanish cassette tapes, flip them over, and I guarantee 5 of them will say Roy Sales is the is the company because, you know, they own the rights to all this stuff. Anyway, so I met Mike, and I was talking to him about how throughout my life, I had always been really poor growing up. But what happened was somehow I always managed to make ends meet. You know, if I needed $200 for rent in 3 days, somehow miraculously I would end up with $210, you know. And I never made so much that it was ridiculous, but I always made just enough to get by. And so I told Mike, I said, you know, it seems to me like money is like a river, right? It's this thing that you can't really put your arms around, you can't control, but if you need it, you just go down and dip a bucket in and come back up. But you can only carry a certain amount of it at a time, right? Some people have bigger buckets. Some people have people to carry other buckets. Me, I don't necessarily care about having all these minions carry my buckets of, you know, water in this metaphor around. But Mike said, that's really interesting. Here's this book you should read. And he gave me a book called The Richest Man in Babylon by George Klassen. I guess it was published in 1926. But it is a collection of parables. And it's, I guess, theoretically biblical in nature, but it's not really a Bible story. But it's this collection of parables set in Babylon. And there's, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, there's The Man Who Desired Gold, The Richest Man in Babylon, Seven Cures for a Lean Purse, you know, Meet the Goddess of Good Luck, Five Laws of Gold. There's all these different things about money. And one of the things that he said in The Richest Man in Babylon is, money is like a river, which I found really interesting. And apparently a lot of people have read this book, The Richest Man in Babylon. It's a very popular and very well-selling book. So what do you guys think about that notion of money being like a river? I thought we might talk about that a little bit.
I think you're crazy, but that's just me. I don't know. I have not had that experience. So for me, it is not. Maybe if you believe in it, it will turn that way, possibly. But my experiences have been, if you need money, you need to work for that money. Or...
Well, I'm not suggesting that you not work for it. I'm not suggesting
in a
Kramer from Seinfeld-esque way, fall ass backwards into money without trying. Having not seen Seinfeld, but, you know, everyone around me has. Oh, that's not true. I saw half of one episode. Hmm.
Did he burst into their apartment unannounced?
I don't know.
That's one of his things.
Kramer's not the one that says giggity. That's the Family Guy, dude.
That's Family Guy. Yeah. That would be Family Guy.
I don't have any idea. Yeah, he probably did burst it. There was some fat mailman. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, some mailman with a glandular disorder. So I'm not suggesting that you don't have to work for it. I'm just saying that if you need money, I think there's something embedded into our subconscious that says, I need this much. I need to make this much. You know, and you sort of make whatever that number is. And my problem is I never, long term, I don't have a number. I have a short term number. And my short term number is always, how much do I need this month to buy the things that I want and to pay rent and to go out to dinner and those sort of things. And so money kind of comes into me on a sort of weird monthly cycle. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a little bit zen, but.
It does not for me. It comes in based on work. It's pretty much the same every 2 weeks.
Well,
not many exceptions. And I base what I want and what I need based on what I know is coming in, not the opposite.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, my perspective is I look at what do I need, and then I just kind of go for it, and the money just sort of happens.
Yeah, I do.
But I mean, I work for it. Don't get me wrong.
It's of not course, like I wasn't implying that.
Channel the spirit of the, you know, great goddess of luck and fortune. I mean, it actually works.
There's a little bit of, there's an element of call it what you will, maybe it's faith, but that idea that you can be kind of comfortable knowing that most of the time, for most people, the opportunities present themselves, whether it be an extension of the things that you're actively creating, like you go to school to get a particular degree, to get a particular job, or you really want to do these things, so you're getting active within a certain community and the opportunities start arriving as a result of making sure that you're a part of this community or being active in this community. It's not just, you're right, not just sitting out on the curb waiting for the pots of gold to start falling from the sky. But at the same time, I can think of one friend in particular who has always lived very, very lean in terms of his income. And for him, it's all about setting up the ability to do what he wants to do for as much time as he can. And the sacrifice for him, the sacrifice has ended up being that he's always just right there on the money. But I've known the guy for 15 years now. And when you meet him, your first impression might be financial ruin and homelessness or whatever is going to strike at any moment. And yet here we are 15 years later. He's never been out in the street. He's always made his rent. He's established a certain way of being and access to certain income. And in such a way that he never does. It's that fear, right? A lot of us have that fear that you're going to, if you don't have this particular steady paycheck or this particular job, that's it. It's either this binary, it's either that income or nothing. And in truth, most of the time, something works out. You might have to make some short-term compromises, but.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up really, really, really poor. And so for me, I look at the things that I have and I kind of think, I don't really need them. I mean, I grew up, you know, I spent a long time, I was able to read, I was able to write, you know, I mean, I don't need to write on a computer. I could do the J.K. Rowling, you know, write on a longhand, you know, Harry Potter if I had to. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting perspective because once you have been really poor and you've had nothing, you know, and you've had hand-me-down clothes, you know, from relatives, not even an older brother because I didn't have an older brother, I had a younger brother. You know, you have this weird perspective, right, where you just kind of go, wow, I'm glad to have all these things, but I don't really need them. You know, they don't have to be in my life. I can find a way to do the things that I care about without them.
And there's a face to the fear, right? I mean, part of the, you can call it maybe even a middle class fear, right? If you haven't experienced that sort of financial hardship, that's something, it's an unknown. Whereas you're saying, you know, if you've lived through a period of relative scarcity, then that's nothing to be afraid of anymore, right? Because you've been there, you know what it's like, and you know you could do it again because you had done it before and you didn't fall off the earth and just because of that hardship.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in Thailand for a while and stayed with people on their farms and stayed in a temple and slept on a dirt floor. And I mean, I'm the kind of person that whatever I have around me, I don't know. I'm one of those weird, apparently. I didn't think I was weird, but in talking to people, since we've started Life Zero, I've started asking a lot more questions about certain aspects of my personality. I'm one of those people, I never get bored, for example. Like the notion of boredom to me is such a foreign concept. I don't understand. We live in a world that has so much available to us, so many things to do. There's so much rich information to absorb. I don't understand how someone could ever be bored. I mean, it's just not a concept I can even wrap my head around.
I get bored.
Do you want to elaborate on that or just insert the little... Laura becomes the interstitial. Yeah. It's a curie LA, I am bored.
You know, if I'm at home, I'm never bored because I have things surrounding me that do occupy me, you know. But for example, I had a doctor's appointment the other day, and we all know how doctor's offices are. My appointment was scheduled for 8:50. I arrived at 8:30. I finally got in to see, well, I was in waiting room one. By 10 a.m., I was transported into waiting room two.
You were in the green room at that point.
Yes, exactly. Right. And then I finally got seen and left by, I'd say, 11:30.
Wow.
For an 8:50 a.m. appointment. So frustrating. But I assumed, maybe stupidly, that I would go in, maybe wait 10, 15 minutes, and... then I would be sent into the room. I would have my appointment taken care of, and then I would leave. I even thought maybe up to a half an hour. Well, you know, I fortunately had my iPhone on me, and so I listened to a podcast that I had loaded on there. Well, the podcast was a half an hour long. When that podcast was over, I didn't have any more. There was no internet access in the doctor's office, and in fact it was like steel, so I couldn't even get, like, I was barely getting Edge. There was not really much to do. They had no magazines laying out.
Highlights?
No,
they
none.
They just have highlights in the doctor's offices.
Not a single magazine. It was chairs and then a water thing that about every 42 seconds went and yes, I had time to count that every 42 seconds. I was bored. I was very, very bored. I had no pen, no paper. Took a bunch of notes on my iPhone, things that I was going to do that day. But I couldn't draw anything. I mean, like, I didn't have games. The 3G network wasn't up, so it's not like I could, you know, order a game on. Yeah, it was awful, and I was bored. So there's a way that I get bored.
Yeah, I wouldn't find myself bored in that situation. I would find myself frustrated because I would feel like my time wasn't being valued. You know, I value their time by getting there early and being available at the time. I mean, theoretically, and this goes back to the customer service issue a little bit, but theoretically, I pay their salary. My presence at their office, paying them, you know, or my HMO or PPO connected to me, pays their salary. And so there's always a big question mark in my mind around, you know, I value their time. I get there early. I fill out the forms. I go through the bureaucracy, you know, for them to make me wait. I mean, I understand people get backed up and people get busy and those sort of things. But, man, what happened to time management? So that's where I would be. I would be frustrated. I would not be bored, though. I mean, I would, you know, you have your iPhone on you. You could have, I mean, I would take notes about projects
that I'm working on.
That
lightsaber thing, isn't there something where you can tilt it, the lightsaber, and you tilt it again, and the lightsaber the other way?
Yeah, the lightsaber is pretty cool. You know what's funny about that? I discovered, I'd say maybe 2 months ago, that it is a lightsaber with a B as in boy. I thought it was a lightsaber, and I have been calling it a lightsaber since I heard about Star Wars when I was a little girl, and it is a saber. I was completely unaware of this fact until somebody noticed that I was using a V instead of a B, which I believe was John over here.
Yeah, that you probably got from one of the previous episodes. One of the little nigglers for me is when people pronounce something incorrectly. Now, I understand I'm the world heavyweight champion of mispronouncing words.
I don't know. I don't think you are.
But I'm at least, you know, the golden belt, whatever, the big gold belt guy.
Then I get the heavyweight, bigger
the welterweight.
Diamond
I'm the welterweight.
Belt.
Yeah. I'm the, you know, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I heard you say it, and I said, "Life, it's not a candy. It's a saber, S-A-B-E-R." And she was like, "Saber? What's that?" And I remember we had to walk through.
Yes,
it's like
did.
A sword, sort of.
Yes,
it's a foil,
did.
Really. It's a
something put out by the EPA so that kids know about energy savings. It's, yeah.
It's a lightsaber.
It's a lightsaber.
That's a very specific type of boredom I think you're talking about, too. I noticed in the early part of the description you were talking about it was being cut off from your typical sort of information flows that led to the and then not having as many things to fall back on as you might like, as opposed to being at home, having things to watch if you want, or things to listen to, or access the internet, or hang out with your friends, and then you still can't find anything to occupy your time. You know, that's to me a whole different class of boredom.
Absolutely. Well, and part of it was like no cell phones. They had a big like no cell phone sign. So like I'm texting, and I actually get looked at, and I get one of those. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my God, I'm texting. I don't even have the clicks on. You can't hear me texting on an iPhone. Ridiculous, for one.
It might be that they have this sort of policy. By the way, that's also one of my favorite words, policy. Policy is a, whenever someone says policy, I immediately hear the word, I'm a jerk, or the phrase, I'm a jerk, you know. Our policy is, oh, you're a jerk, nice. So It might be a policy in the same way that the airline has a policy. They believe somehow, miraculously, that the radio waves being emitted from your cell phone could cause problems with their gear or their machinery in some way.
Dude, it's not a hospital. It's a doctor's office. Seriously. It was like not even a high-end thingy here.
Well, and what's interesting about that entire flawed set of logic, if you know anything about technology, is the mere possession of the phone on you and the phone not being turned off causes it to transmit and receive information with some frequency and on a frequency, ironically.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sort of situation where in order for your phone to not be a problem, you would have to turn it off, you know? Or if you have an iPhone, I guess put it in airplane mode.
Yeah.
But that's not the issue that they take. They take, you know, they take issue with the being on it on a phone call or texting on it. Somehow that's what activates it, you know.
Yeah. But back to bored. I
this
get
is
bored.
Why I never get bored.
Yeah.
Because I run through
See,
the myriad of things in my head.
I try to sing songs for a while, and that works really well. The thing is, like, give me a book. Even if I don't like the book, I won't be bored because I'll still read it if I have nothing else to do, you know? No, then I can talk to somebody later and be like, wow, have you read this? It totally sucks, and this is why, you know? But regardless, it's something to do. It's when I'm put in a situation in which I don't have anything to do. And I know you have a very active mind, John, so you can do a million things in your mind. I, on the other hand, think my mind is very active, but my mind is like, look over there, look over there, look over there. It's not focused on like one thing for a long period of time. So it's like, you know, I can start to think about something, but then like, a butterfly goes by, and I'm done with that and on to something else.
I've been hanging out in the wrong waiting room. You got butterflies flying by you.
Exactly. Ooh, something shiny. I don't want to mischaracterize. I have the same issue. I mean, we all do. We have an unquiet mind, all of us. And I mean, that's a byproduct of being alive and in this society. I mean, you have a human.
Or I would say a mammal. I think my cats have very active and live minds that are constantly going, except when they're sleeping. But they do dream.
John, how do you feel about the cats dreaming? You seem to have a policy, if you will, on anthropomorphizing animals.
When I was in college, one of the nicknames that I received, because it was right around the time that Star Trek Next Generation was coming out or was out or already out, whatever, I received the nickname Data. Data, if you are familiar with Star Trek The Next Generation, Data was the android, the emotionless, by the way, I'd like to point out, android who was really calculating or logical.
But he was also very, very smart and always knew the answer. Positive intent.
So the interesting thing about Data was I'd never really seen a lot of episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, but I really got into it in the second season once people started calling me Data, mm-hmm. because I found myself kind of connected to this character. Because I think in a lot of ways, you know, one of the things we try and do as me personally, I'm an INTP on the temperament chart. And the I part of it, a lot of people think that it's how much you talk or that sort of thing. It's not. It's how much you reveal about yourself. And so I was always very cautious to reveal too much about myself. So I really identified with this character, Data. Mm-hmm. And I found there was a particular episode, and I'm going to totally butcher it, but there was a particular episode where Picard asked Data to figure something out, and he just spat out the answer, like, instantly. And Picard said, wow, that was really quick. And he said, well, in the 500 milliseconds it took me to calculate that, I also calculated, and he just rattled off like 24 things that he was doing at the mm-hmm. same time. And that's a little bit of an extreme version, obviously, but I always thought of myself as that kind of mind. It's like, yeah, I can kind of focus on that one thing at the top, but the other things in the background are still making a lot of noise in my head in the time I'm calculating. Something.
That there's one thing at a time in mind. It's a very, very short-lived and one at a time.
You are, to use computer parlance, you would have what is referred to as a FIFO queue, first in, first out queue.
Oh, that's
just
in math,
stack.
Too.
Yeah.
That's in the parentheses when you did the, I remember that. That was like seventh grade.
It might be a random access stack, actually, if you really aren't, you know, if you're flitting from thing to thing,
right.
And you're not necessarily processing those in order.
But it's not random. Something occurs that makes it trigger.
So then to get back to the computer science metaphor, you would be more like a single-tasking operating system like the original Macintosh. One thing at a time.
Okay.
In order to do something else, you literally have to stop doing the one thing and go to the other one. Is that true?
I don't know.
Do you really think that you're?
I think mostly I am. I think sometimes other thoughts can, you know, go through the back. The problem is I try so hard to focus on what I like to. If I'm doing something, I want to focus on just that. So it's like I will actually, if I start to think about something else, I'll lose track of what I'm doing and, you know, kind of be lost before I can jump back on. Or I just moved on to something directly after that that was somehow more sticky.
See, now you're just being mean.
Why does that mean? Like it just stuck in there better. It was
stickier. Well, it's at least dismissive. Maybe I just moved on to something else
this
that was more
one time
parenthetically important. But I'm going to say the word sticky to make you feel
sticky.
Better. Because sticky is a nice neutral word where unimportant is...
You know what? Maybe I just don't know a big perfect word to go there. So sticky was the only one that in my brain that I could come up with. Unlike you who has your 5-star letter. Okay.
She wasn't going for triple word scores, but she's trying to tell you.
Yes. I was going for the only word that would... even remotely make sense there that I
Lara,
could think
sometimes
of.
Sometimes sticky is the big perfect word.
I thought it worked fine. I thought it went well in my phrase.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Chuck Palahniuk. He's the author of Fight Club, Choke. Mm-hmm. Choke is actually coming out as a movie, but Chuck Palahniuk, one time someone said to him in an interview, how is it possible that you write so well? And he said, I don't write well. I write terribly. Are you kidding me? He goes, I try every imaginable way to think of another word for big when I'm talking about a statue or when I'm talking about something. He goes, you know, I'm thinking gargantuan and gigantic and all. And he goes, and eventually I just write, it was a really big fucking statue. And apparently, you know, that works.
Right.
You know, it's the sort of strunk and white rule of omit needless words, which the problem, though, Lara Lee, is my 5-star, 5-triple-word score, 5-letter, whatever. Those, to me, are the perfect synthesis of what I'm trying to say in the most, like, Spartan way, right? It's the most terse I can be. And that's what I do. I try and just use a singular or just a couple of tiny words. But then it turns out that those words sometimes seem like I'm playing Scrabble with you.
In that rant alone, you used four words that I had to think twice about. Go, oh yeah. You know, like had to hear more to realize how they would fit in the sentence. Your vocabulary is very, very large.
It's fucking big, as Chuck Palahniuk would say.
Right. Go for the impact.
Yeah, can we climb off my vocabulary and onto another topic?
We've been at this for a little while now, so... and you've been at the Life Zero thing even as you were coming up with it sort of getting things going. What would you say are the differences in the way that you relate to the world, having paid attention to these things in the context of the rules, the guidelines of Life Zero? Are you noticing yourself? What are you noticing yourself doing differently these days?
You know, interestingly,
if anything.
Well, yeah, I'm doing a lot of things differently. I'm also striking a balance a lot more. When I first started Life Zero, it was totally out of control, insane. I got rid of everything. I mean, I literally pulled the cord and just all the cargo came out the back. I was like, that's it, I'm done. I was down to like, you know, including socks and clothes and underwear and computer, everything. I was down to like 87 items. And then, I don't know, some measure of reason took over and I started saying, well, what do I actually need? And, you know, I started putting together more things. But the thing I've noticed most, it's interesting. The thing I've noticed most actually has to do with this podcast, which is I've noticed that there are not a lot of thoughtful conversations happening in podcasts or on the radio or these other places. You know, the kind of conversation that we have on Life Zero, I've had people actually come up to me and say, I tried to listen to it. You guys are just, it's a pointless conversation that you're having. It's meandering, mm-hmm. although they don't use the word meandering, Larly. They say, you know, but that's the synthesis of all of the different things that they say. Well, yeah, they say it sucks. And I say, well, why does it suck? And they go, cuz. And I go, well, why cuz? And then they just, I'm like, do you not like this? Do you not like that? And I just, I poke and prod until eventually I get at, you know, the person listening to it has trouble following the, as you mentioned earlier, sort of long, drawn out, complicated explanations for something. But I like to think of it differently. I like to think of it more as we are having a discourse or a dialogue that you don't really have. I mean, I mentioned one time that I'm a big fan of Charlie Rose. Well, I like to think of Life Zero as Charlie Rose for lifestyle design. And I was shocked to find out, I thought everybody watched Charlie Rose.
Turns out not to be the case. I don't watch Charlie Rose, but it's funny. I've run into a number of folks more recently. There's this sect of Charlie Rose fanatics, and they're out there. And from their point of view, yeah, it is a Charlie Rose world, and why isn't everyone on the bus with me sort of thing.
Exactly.
Is Charlie Rose the guy that does those interviews?
Mm-hmm.
I know that's really broad, but I think you know, like, the one...
The late
with
night.
The economic... The Economist.
The one with the economicist?
Yeah, I lost myself there. Yeah, the one from that one time that you shared with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I know exactly Charlie Rose is. Okay, I like Charlie Rose. I don't watch it regularly.
Well, you saw the one episode.
No, I've seen a few more since then on the internet.
Interesting.
I don't know if they're full on the internet, but they are on there.
You're right, though, that it is sort of... you don't come across that level of depth in that sort of format as often. So I can see why folks who are really drawn to the extended discourse would be excited about a Charlie Rose.
Yeah, I don't understand. Here's the part that I can't wrap my brain around. How is it possible that someone can listen to an audiobook or listen to NPR but not put up with Charlie Rose or a Life Zero-like podcast? Because an audiobook to me is much less interesting generally than a conversation between a couple of people who are really trying to get at an answer to a big question that they have. A lot of times to me, an audiobook is, or even a book most of the time, is 300 pages of something that could probably have been said in 80 pages.
You're talking about nonfiction books.
Yeah, nonfiction books. Right. I'm talking about the sort of conversation, you know, the I'm talking to you, Thomas Friedman, the world is flat. The only thing not flat about you is your book. It's so thick, it's ridiculous. It could have been said in 80 pages. I'd like to do a search for how many times the world is flat as a phrase occurs in that book. And I would imagine we could create an 80-page book just out of the number of occurrences of just that phrase.
Jared Diamond strikes me that way. Guns, Germs, and Steel, yeah, collapse. Right. Jared Diamond. I don't remember whether or not he's an academic or not, but it strikes me as a very sort of academic approach to the book. Like, I'm going to give you the abstract of my book in the introduction and tell you everything I'm going to tell you. Then I'm going to tell you.
Right. It's that old.
I told you, but now I'm gonna really.
It's that old sales thing, right? Tell them what you're gonna tell them, then tell them,
right?
Then tell them what you told them.
Sure.
It's that old sales pitch thing.
Good information, but I found myself buying the thesis early on and wondering, you know, why I would needed to hear the extrapolation later on all the other things that tied into it. I liked the executive summary, I guess you will.
Right. It's the sort of Malcolm Gladwell problem, right? Where the Blink is a perfect example of this, right? Where he tells you everything you need to know in the first chapter.
In the liner notes.
Yeah, in the liner notes, in the cover, the jacket, in the back, right under his name. He tells you everything you need to know. But he spends the whole book talking about anecdotes. But in the case of Blink, it's those anecdotes that really make it.
Mm.
In the case of Guns, Germs, and Steel, it's shockingly anecdote-free for how much information is in there.
Yeah, it's ammunition for the thing that he wanted to say at the beginning, which right. is good if you really want to dive in or if you want to refute the thing or if you're looking for holes in the reasoning or whatever, then that's his sort of shoring up the argument the whole time. But
so I guess I'm talking about opposite extremes, and I guess you said how what's changed. Well, that's the big thing that's changed is I've noticed these two extremes much more than I did before. I've noticed these sort of flowery, constantly talking sort of prose, you know, in the Jared Diamond-like notion of it. And then I've noticed the soundbite side on the other side. And there's the perfect middle to me is this sort of Charlie Rose part of it.
Hmm.
The part where you don't assume that people are stupid, and so you have to tell them something 1,000 times for them to understand it in 1,000 different ways. You assume that they're smart enough to get the gist of what you're saying, and so you just kind of move forward, you know. And in the world of DVRs and podcasts and things, it's not like someone can't rewind if they've missed a point. So I've noticed that, and I've noticed how I am squarely in that Charlie Rose camp. And I don't mean I mean Charlie Rose metaphorically, not Charlie Rose the person. Just I am squarely in that camp. I don't want to listen to The World is Flat. It's too long and tedious, you know. But I'll listen to a podcast like Life Zero,
mm-hmm.
where I hear people having an intelligent discourse, although questionably intelligent in our case, but an intelligent discourse in other cases about something they're interested in.
Something that strives for a certain intelligence, we hope. How about you, Laura? Anything you've noticed, nuanced changes in your behavior?
Ticks? No, not really.
An eye that can't stop blinking, anything like that?
No.
You're keeping on giving. You're absorbing the information and the input.
Yeah. Absorbing away, but I'm still me.
So I'm not saying that I'm not me. We're asking the question, and you're telling us that there is no situation in which you have noticed yourself behaving differently as a result of being a part of Life Zero.
Even if you notice yourself doing something and say, this is really not Life Zero-y of me, and I like it.
Because I would argue that...
Oh, I have gone shopping several times since Life Zero and bought stuff, and I have done the whole, like, go home and be like, wow, don't need any of it, but love it all.
Go.
So there you go.
So there's an awareness.
But I used to do that too.
But would you think of those things? You would go through the sort of, do I really need this? You'd go through that phase before we started having these discussions or thinking along these lines?
Oh, I would always think, you know, I don't necessarily need this. I just want it. But, you know, now I it has occurred to me how very unlife zero of me.
I ran into something just this weekend that sort of made me think of the guidelines and how I am or am not relating to them. I did the 48-hour film project with some friends over the weekend, which is something that happens every year. I've only done it 2 years in a row, but it's a lot of fun. You get folks together and try and make a short film with heavy constraints. You only get 48 hours, and it's usually a bunch of folks who don't do this day in, day out. So just getting something out the other end can be challenging. And we were fishing around for things to use for props for a given scene, or a couple different scenes. And in my garage, which has stuff in it, like a lot of folks' garages, stuff that I've been meaning to get rid of, we were able to very quickly, without going anywhere and shopping for anything or needing to go outside of the confines of the garage, found a bunch of props to use in these scenes. And I thought to myself, well, this is kind of almost an anti-Life Zero thing, in that one of the things that I liked to try, at least, you could call this a big rationalization, but distinguish between when I'm bringing things into my life, was things that were tools or things that could be used to create something, as opposed to just things, either that are the pretty or are just there to have around. It was like things that I could use to make things, whether that be a camera or a piece of hardware or an instrument or something like that. And this wasn't even that stuff necessarily. I was talking about a section of lead pipe that had been there when we bought the place and was just sitting there in the garage. We ended up using it as the prop for some scene. And I thought to myself, if I had really done the purge, the landscape of available things to use in this creative process would have been a lot more constrained. Now, the counter argument to that, of course, being you could have just gone out to Goodwill or a junk shop or something and found a bunch of stuff too. But there, I guess I'm wondering if there isn't something to be said for stuff as creative launch pad or as inspirational material. I know that a lot of, you know, artist studios tend to have just stuff in them that's just there to trigger an idea or something like that. So I guess the question is that a big old rationalization, which is probably the case, or is there something to be said for the stuff that's not necessarily always needed and right, but it's there when you decide to use it in that particular context?
I think, you know, it's funny you talk about that. I actually, in the original Life Zero rules, the third rule, I mean, this was over a year ago when I started writing them down. The third rule was, if it creates, it doesn't count, which is exactly what you're talking about. That's a really interesting one too. You know, and create can be, you know, described in a lot of different ways. So if it creates, it doesn't count. I think that's a really good, maybe I'll add that to the rules. I think it's a worthwhile thing to do, because it does a couple things. One is it gives, you know, it's a contribution back to the world by creating something, putting something into it. And it also gives you some context. So here's an example. I have a camera. My camera creates, obviously, footage, which I can then edit, you know. I have microphones, which we're using right now. Those create content, which we can edit, you know, Life Zero into. Should I count? You know, I struggle with this, just like you did with your garage. Should I be counting the microphones around this table as four things? Or, although this whole notion of counting we've gone over, you know, but, or should I simply say, this creates, so this shouldn't count toward what I worry about? You know.
Yeah, I guess the taking just the lead pipe as an example. On the one hand, we used it because it was there. On the other hand, it sat for 3 years in the little piece of unfinished wall where it was, I don't know, placed by somebody way back when.
Right.
And in all likelihood, unless I, you know, need to defend myself with a very heavy weapon that I can get to, or we make a bunch of stuff that has to do with lead pipes, it's probably going to sit there for another 3 years unless I get rid of it. So that's why I wonder if it's a rationalization to have these things, because it's very easy to go down that road with everything, right, and say, well, I could create something with this, but so I can't get rid of it because, oh, what if I need to? That's, you know, that's one of the crutches, right, of not being able to get rid of things, is that,
right,
oh, I might use it.
Well, that's why there's the 6 month unused lose it rule, mm-hmm. Right? So if you had followed that rule, you would have gotten rid of the lead pipe and you wouldn't have had it.
Wouldn't have had a movie.
You wouldn't have had a movie.
Sat there all weekend.
The lead pipe was the crucial thing that you needed for your movie.
The creative crux. Yes.
That was it. It was the lead pipe. Not the camera or the crew. It was the pipe. The pipe held it all together.
Yeah.
The pipe was like the force from Star Wars. Without it, that was it. There were no midichlorians.
Speaking of counting things.
Yeah.
That's the count that they put on. The Force was just this thing. And then, what was it, episode one? They decided to make it this measurable attribute. So you could, I could hold up the reader, or I could do some tests and figure out.
Yeah, the women's big, the razor, the sheer elegance razor that they modified into the midichlorian counter.
So instead of being this mystical thing that sort of is felt or not felt within people, it's it's just something you measure. You either got it or you don't.
I want to talk about something that I found over the weekend or over the last week. It's the July 14th issue of Time Magazine, the annual Making of America issue. And it caught my attention for a couple of reasons. One is it has The Dangerous Mind of Mark Twain on the cover. And the other is it has this photo of Mark Twain. I'm going to try and find a link to some of this for the show notes. The photo of Mark Twain, for some reason, I have always loved this photo. His hair is unkempt. He's got a nice Brillo pad mustache. He has crazy Martin Scorsese eyebrows. You know, he's totally out of control. And I'm also a big fan of his writing, by the way. But I was struck, you know, and I read it because I thought, wow, I got to read what somebody else thinks about Mark Twain and why he is a dangerous mind. Because anyone who is pegged as a dangerous mind, I'm going to find interesting in some way or another. But there's let's see, what page is this? On page 54 and 55, there's something called Man of the World. And Jackson Dykeman wrote this particular aspect of it. And I got to say, this is probably the most interesting thing that I've ever seen in relation to Mark Twain in the history of my taking a look at what Mark Twain has done in his life. And what it is it's a two-page spread of all of the places that he traveled from 1857 until about 1905. Now, I should point out, Mark Twain lived from 1835 to 1910. And so 1857 to 1905 is pretty hardcore. I mean, that's a fair chunk of his life. But if you look at this map, once again, I'll try and provide links to it. If you look at this map, here is a guy who traveled across the United States. I mean, we all know he went up and down the Mississippi, but he traveled across the United States. He was in Nicaragua. He was in Hawaii. He was in Canada. He was in France, Germany, England, Italy. He was in the Ottoman Empire, Egypt, Morocco. He was in South Africa. He was in India for a while, and actually quite a bit of India. He was in Australia, and he was in New Zealand from 1857 till 1905. And I was struck by, because one of the rules is travel more. And I think it gives you great perspective. I was completely struck by three things. One, how open-minded Mark Twain was toward race relations. And I wonder if travel didn't have something to do with that. Two, how completely connected he was to the world and the sensibilities of the world. So while he disagreed with a lot of the racial politics and a lot of politics in general, he was very connected to the world. He could write something that people would read and understand. You know, that Chuck Palahniuk kind of simplicity way of writing that people got. I mean, I love Chuck Palahniuk. And then the third thing that is the most striking in a lot of ways is how much he was able to actually travel in a time where there were no planes. I mean, he was on a boat.
Mm-hmm. Steamer for all of that stuff.
Yeah. And here is an old man, by any argument, you know, I mean, he would have been 65 when he spent some time in, you know, like basically India and Africa. He was 60 when he hit India. 60. That's shocking to me. So that just tells me that, you know, there's almost no excuse. And I'd also like to point out, Mark Twain was not rich. A lot of people think that he was rich, but he was very poor. He kept losing money and having all of these issues. And, you know, he had two children die. One of them died at 22, two daughters. One died at 22 and one died at 29. And, you know, he had a lot of hardship in his life. His wife died way before him. You know, he had financial hardship. He had emotional hardship. He was popular, but, you know, a lot of people wanted him dead. And yet here's a guy who in his 60s managed to get to India on a boat. I just, you know, I don't know what else to say other than it just blows my mind that, you know, you want to talk about things that caught me off guard. That is a perfect example of, since we've started doing Life Zero and I've started thinking about travel more and blockades and money like a river, and you know, you should do what you love and it will just happen. there's an example of someone doing what he loved, and it just worked out for him.
I can't speak from experience as someone who's done a ton of traveling. I've been a few places in the world and hope to go to a lot more, but I can't, even if you do a bunch of sort of local alternate path finding where you're just taking different routes to places. We did a trip just recently up an hour and a half north of where we live. And yet anytime you do that sort of thing and you're going to a place that is foreign to you, that's the big thing, right? It's foreign to you just because you haven't been there before. That perspective shift, I think, is invaluable. And I've never heard of anybody saying that they did a bunch of traveling and didn't gain a bunch from it. Maybe the exception might be folks who are just on a sort of vacation treadmill where they've chosen their place that they like to go and they go there every year and they eat at the same place or they stay at the same hotel. Maybe that's an exception to it. But this sort of the worldliness that can come from exploring things that are outside of what you know and what's comforting, it's just a physical manifestation of that, right? You're getting outside of what's known to hopefully broaden your perspectives. Can't be a bad thing.
There's a lot of traveling I want to do. However, you know, I don't think it would be very fun to spend the time and the money and make the effort to travel internationally just to be there for 3 days or 4 days. And given, you know, being in school and the jobs that I've had and such, my time at this point has not been opened enough for me to, you know, do like a 2-3 month, you know, explore Europe kind of thing, which I would rather wait for a time that I could do that because I know it's going to come because I can make that happen in the future a lot easier than, you know, when I was in college trying to, you know, scrape enough money and save enough through the year to do that over the summer. But then I was working over the summer because I needed the money for the next year and stuff. And so, you know, as opposed to just flying over 3-4 days and going, oh, that was neat coming home. I don't think that's going to be enough of an experience for me, so.
You know, some of us just throw ourselves into the distance and then work while we're there and just figure it out.
Yeah, that's some people. That's not a me people.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but to me, that local exploration, if you will, I've surprised myself because I've always had it in my mind that I'm not going to go traveling unless I can go. So I'm going to Egypt or I'm going to this, that, or the other. But to me, I think it's maybe a little too bald to just say it's gotta be a huge leap or a huge distance to get that perspective jerk. It's something to be said for being a different culture, but I would argue that, in a place like California, you can get to the Central Valley and the culture is markedly different than San Francisco. So it doesn't take a huge amount of distance to get that same perspective jerk that's getting you out of your comfort.
Right. And there's two different things, right? There's a perspective shift, which is what you're talking about, which I completely agree on. And there are plenty of actually Bill Bryson is a really great travel writer who wrote A Walk in the Woods and other things. But he talks about some of that, you know, just different things in a specific area.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck Palahniuk wrote a book about the trails in Portland. He talked about different like off the beaten path kind of places in Portland. But there's two different ways to look at this. One is there is that perspective shift, and we are very fortunate living in the Bay Area that we can go, you know, north, you know, south or east or northeast or southeast and hit just a wildly different area with wildly different, you know, it's mountain or whatever. And then if we go west, we're in the ocean. I mean, mm-hmm. There's a lot going on there. We can head down to Monterey. We could head up to Tahoe. We could go to, I guess, Yosemite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just a lot going on there. That's pretty shocking. And that is one definite way to change your perspective. When you travel internationally, it changes your perspective in a different way because it doesn't rattle that perspective that you have. It rattles the sort of part of you that's connected to culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a lot different than the perspective. I mean, neither one is better than the other. It's just a completely different way of looking at it.
Thank you.
If you want to share your perspective on culture or travel or whatever, however you look at the world, you should send us an email at lifezero@me.com. And if you're interested in arguing with us in person and live in the Bay Area, send us an email at the same address, or you can join us on Skype. I think Laura Lee is done. I think we're going to have to call this an episode. She looks like she has wandered off where the butterflies are in the distance, writing little shopping lists.
I'm just listening.
You're gone. You're glossy-eyed and disconnected.
I was just listening, really.
What's
no,
coming?
Totally.
Money is like a river.
We've got to catch this little bend.
And my canoe is filling with water. I found flowers.
Durbanisms.
Yes, there you go. Durbanisms to add into the after show that Ben doesn't listen to, so he never gets to know all the fun little things.
Surprise is lurking for me for later. That's how I like it. It's like a treasure trove waiting for me to, when I'm having a slow day, I'll just open it up and be delighted.
I like that.
You'll listen to Life Zero when you're having a slow day.
Just the after show, yeah.
Oh, just the yeah. after show.
I will assemble the after shows together into just a 3 minutes of joy.